The Spectator magazine combines incisive political commentary with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Stock up on your summer reading with a 12-week subscription, in print and online for just £12. Plus, we'll send you a copy of Spectator columnist Lionel Shriver's new book, The Motion of the Body Through Space, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/Lionel.
Hello and welcome to Coffeehouse Shots, the Spectator's daily and sometimes more than daily politics podcast. I'm John Connolly and I'm joined today by James Forsyth and Katie Balls. For this Saturday episode of Shots, we'll be talking about the looming COVID inquiry into how the government has handled its response to the coronavirus. In the magazine this week, James writes that there's an acceptance by staff in Number 10 that an inquiry is on the way, with some even drawing up a timeline of their actions since January. James, to start us off then, we know that the UK has had a pretty high number of deaths compared to other countries. How do you think the government feels about the inquiry, and in terms of how damning or critical do you think it will be?
So I think a public inquiry is inevitable. You cannot have more than 50,000 deaths from a new virus and then not have an inquiry into how the government handled it. Now, I think in Number 10 there is a certain confidence that the inquiry will bear out that their central contention that they followed the scientific advice that they were given in the first half of this year. I think their view is that, you know, there's not going to be a moment when people say, the Prime Minister overruled Sage on this or that. So I think to that extent they are safe. I think we saw in Boris Johnson's appearance at the liaison committee last week, one of their arguments, which is going to be the UK's pandemic plan, which had been much lauded before this crisis, was aimed at the wrong enemy. It was aimed at an influenza pandemic, not a coronavirus-style disease. And I thought you could see in that, Boris Johnson made that point rather pointedly to Jeremy Hunt, who was obviously Health Secretary for 6 years when that plan was sitting on the shelf.
And Katie, it seems with this sort of high numbers of deaths, the book has to stop somewhere. Do you get any sense of where that might be?
Well, I think we've seen ultimately in everything the government has said publicly that they keep talking about the scientific advice. So I think it's quite clear, and as James explains in his column, that I think the first port of call in this is to say we followed the scientific advice. Now, I think there is a balancing act to be done there. We saw what happened when Therese Coffey a few weeks ago suggested, you know, if they'd done the wrong thing, it might be because they'd done the wrong advice. Now, I think since then, you had people around Therese Coffey say that she hadn't meant it as, you know, blaming the scientists. Number 10 hit back slightly. And in defence of the Work and Pension Secretary, she was ultimately just continuing the logical line that comes from repeatedly saying you're following the scientific advice. But I think the fact that the government sought to try and clarify those comments by saying, you know, we're not blaming scientists, shows that there is a balancing act to be done, even if that is the first defence. I think that, as we've seen, and as James also touches on, the one mistake where Boris Johnson is willing to say, you know, we got this wrong, and we saw this on the liaison committee, is the fact that the UK was preparing for something like influenza rather than a coronavirus. I think this is also a very easy thing for the government to say, oh, you know, this isn't, you know, this is something we did wrong, because it predates Boris Johnson. You can point it at Jeremy Hunt, but actually you can go even further back, to previous administrations. And again, then those in turn can say, well, we were listening to our scientific advisers, that's why we were preparing. So I respect even those health secretaries that presided over planning more on that would say it goes back to the scientific advice. So I think generally speaking, the main thing is going to be scientific advice and then people who oversaw those decisions, but you go around a little bit in a circle on those. One thing that keeps coming up, you know, is are we going to have blue on blue, you know, blame game? And there's been several stories saying, you know, Matt Hancock is going to be the government's fall guy in this. Now, I think it is fair to say that the health secretary has rubbed a few people up the wrong way in government during coronavirus. And there probably are some who think that he has questions to answer in an inquiry. However, I just don't think from the Conservative Party perspective it is practical and likely that your main defence is going to be that someone in the government did something wrong. I think they want to move away from that as a general theme.
And James, you mentioned in your column in terms of other areas where the blame might lay is is also that Public Health England has come under a lot of criticism for sort of its organisations of testing and track and trace at the beginning. How much blame do you think can be laid at their door as sort of a part of the government but not quite part of it as well?
I think Public Health England will get a lot of the blame because the failure to get testing increased earlier on was one of the big flaws in the UK response. If you'd been able to increase testing earlier, you would have A, been able to keep track and trace going for longer. Secondly, you would have been able to test more NHS staff more quickly, and that might have stopped some of the hospital-bound instances of this infection. And you also would have been able to test everyone before they went into a care home. All of which would have probably help the UK's response to it. So I think Public Health England is going to be heavily criticised on that front. I think Public Health England is also getting the blame for this idea that this virus could not be transmitted asymptomatically, when we now know that people are often most contagious just before they show symptoms. So I think Public Health England has a problem. It also has a problem in that Public Health England has no defenders. It doesn't have the status in our public life that the NHS does, for example. So I think Public Health England is bound to be criticised. I think on Katie's point about whether there'll be blue on blue, I mean, I think there will be some criticism by the government, of the previous government, the May government, and its handling. But I think there is a growing realisation that, you know, that forming a circular firing squad would not be a wise move.
Mm. And Katie, I realise it's sort of early stages still at this point, but is there any particular idea about what format the inquiry will take? I know we've had sort of quite famous big inquiries in the past, like Chilcot and Leveson and so on. Are we thinking similar things?
Yeah, I mean, at the moment, no one in government will publicly say there's going to be an inquiry. We've had Nicola Sturgeon suggest there will be one, but in terms of Westminster government, no one even wants to get into that conversation. So we don't have a strong sense. I think clearly the government, if they get a say in picking who's going to lead the inquiry, are going to want to pick someone who doesn't make it, you know, a witch hunt where there has to be a scalp at the end of it. And I think there's also a question, as James says in his piece, of timing, in the sense that part of the reason we need to learn lessons from how the UK government has dealt with coronavirus is because we could be heading to a situation where we're perhaps living with this virus for quite a long time. We could be heading to a second peak. And also just even if coronavirus does, you know, is on the decline, doesn't prove to be something which changes our lives, you know, indefinitely, there is now, I think, a growing sense that in the years to come we could get more things like this. I don't think people are going to forget this lockdown. I think going forward there will want to be the sense that should this happen again, a different virus, the same virus, you know, something like this, we're in much better shape to respond to it. Look, for example, you know, how South Korea, countries that were worst affected by SARS, had systems in place, so they haven't had quite the turmoil that we have had in here, other parts of Europe, America to a degree. So I think for those reasons, people don't want this just to go on and on indefinitely. You want to have something where it's actually constructive, so it is actually useful for the country for the years ahead.
And James, you've written in your piece about the fact that there's sort of a rolling inquiry already going on internally and Whitehall's perhaps changing how it does things. How do you think the sort of the civil service and sort of more the machinery of government is changing after the coronavirus?
I think this has been a kind of massive stress test for how the government operates. And the fact that you've had Simon Case appointed as a permanent secretary at number 10, a job that has been kind of unfilled since Jeremy Hayward came back to do that job after the financial crisis. That is an implicit admission that the central government has not functioned as it should have done. Now, I think what's interesting, making my inquiries about this piece this week, is that there seems to be agreement on both the civil service and the political side on the need for change. Now, I'm not saying that means that, you know, Boris Johnson and Mark Sebel have exactly the same ideas about how Whitehall should change after this. But I think they both accept that there are going to need to be changes to the structures, the way things work. Because this crisis has revealed what works and, just as, if not more importantly, what doesn't work. And I think that is going to lead to change in the way that things are done. I mean, there are clearly bits of the British state that have failed quite badly in this crisis.
And Katie, in terms of what doesn't work, do you think sort of an admission that maybe there needs to be more control from the centre and number 10 in these sort of appointments and changes?
Yeah, I mean, I think Public Health England and the fact that there's a spread of responsibility, and also I think if you look at care homes, it's something that regularly comes up in terms of whether government feels that having a more centralised control board, etc., would have helped. I think in terms of Number 10 and how they operate, I think it's definitely a view in Cabinet that it has become too centralised, that Cabinet has become, you know, decorational. But at the same time, the sense I get is that the view within Number 10 is, if anything, things would have been better had they had more control. So I think that there is an increased appetite to lead from there. I think getting different civil servants in, you have the arrival of Simon Case, is working out how best to manage things. And I think there is a sense of, you know, driving action as well as just coming up with policy ideas should be in Number 10. So I think you could see a slight restructuring, but I don't think it would be what would please some in the party, because I feel that while there are Tory MPs and ministers who feel they have not been consulted enough in this process, I don't get the sense that the lesson Number 10 believes it has learned is that there should be more consultation.
Right. And James, you mentioned there's sort of going to be a creation of a new office inside Number 10, as a project management office. How does that fit into all this?
So previously, Number 10 has basically made policy, and then policy has been delivered elsewhere. What's different about this Office of Project Management is this is basically Number 10 supervising the implementation of policy. So for the first time in kind of living memory, Number 10 is now involved in the delivery of policy as well as making policy. And the other interesting aspect of this Office of Project Management is it's essentially taking a kind of crack team of civil servants, and they solve one problem and then they're sent off to solve another problem. And essentially it's kind of trying to troubleshoot your way around Whitehall, which is an interesting idea. And I think it reflects a kind of feeling that, again, you look at some of the things that what this crisis has shone a light on. There's lots of things that everyone knew were not great. So everyone has known for years that government procurement has had problems. And the PPE crisis has highlighted that. Everyone has known for years that government IT has had problems. The issues with the NHS app are highlighting that again. And so I think what you're seeing is that, you know, the tide has gone out, and, you know, we are seeing which organisations are not fit for purpose. And I think that is going to be a big... Now, it is much easier to identify problems than to solve them. And I think that is one of the kind of big questions about this. I also think you're going to see, for example, one of the things that means the government wants to change its social care policy is this crisis has shown that ultimately the public hold the government responsible for what happens in care homes. You know, no minister at any point has said lots of these care homes are private businesses, and so it's not our job to get PPE to these care homes that are private businesses. No one has attempted that line of defence. But at the same time, there's a frustration in government that they remember at the beginning of this crisis, one of the big worries was that coronavirus was going to kind of spread through prisons like wildfire. And you'd be left with this choice of either releasing huge numbers of prisoners or having kind of horribly large numbers of deaths on the prison estate. That hasn't happened. Now, in government, they think one of the reasons why that hasn't happened is that because the prison system is kind of very centralised, the Ministry of Justice could basically issue edicts to prison governors saying, do this, do that, while as they have been unable to issue edicts to care homes, because some of them are run by local councils, some of them are run by charities, some of them are run by private businesses. And so there's a kind of feeling they've got to sort that. And I think this is one of the kind of questions of government, which is, I think they're going to have to act on social care, because more than 1 in 10 social care residents have died during this crisis. And I think that there will have to be, A, some kind of act of, frankly, national atonement for that. And secondly, the Tories at the next election will have to be able to say about this whole coronavirus crisis, yes, that was bad, but we fixed that problem. And that, I think, is one of the other reasons why it is not tenable just to kind of kick social care into the long grass, as has happened repeatedly since 2008.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Katie. And thank you for listening.
The Spectator magazine combines incisive political commentary with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Stock up on your summer reading with a 12-week subscription, in print and online, for just £12. Plus, we'll send you a copy of Spectator columnist Lionel Shriver's new book, The Motion of the Body Through Space, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/Lionel.